Wait a minute, this sounds like rock and or roll.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ. On today's episode, you're going to get to hear a conversation I had with John Montgomery, who was the frontman for a 70s rock band in New York City called Street Punk. And Street Punk were on the same bill with Kiss at the Hotel Diplomat in August of 1973, one of the earliest Kiss shows. And I talked to John about his career in rock and roll dating back to the 60s, and then we talked about a lot of the other bands that were a part of that 70s rock scene that Kiss came out of, that the New York Dolls were a big part of, that the Ramones eventually came out of. And you'll get to hear songs by some of those bands as well as you listen, like the Magic Tramps and Harlots of 42nd Street and Teenage Lust and the Rags, etc. And also, John was kind enough to send me over some Street Punk recordings that he did in the 90s to recreate the songs from the 70s, that the recordings of those no longer exist. So here it is. I hope you enjoy it. My conversation with John Montgomery.
He's Lord and High Priest. Where he's needed the least, he's one of those regular dudes. That master of flash, till his mind starts to crash. It's come so he's hard to refuse. 12-year-olds with painted faces follow him around. Even girls in satin and laces know when he's in town. He's all
what do you want to know about that?
Yeah, where to begin, right? Well, yeah. So Street Punk wasn't your first band, right? You were in a couple bands before that?
No. Yeah, I was in, I started in doo-wop when I was very young. I was discovered singing. I was working at Palisades Amusement Park and doing all sorts of jobs, including guessing age and weight, and I would get my doo-wop guys together and sing. And, a couple of Bruce Morrow and Clay Cole heard me singing and asked me if I wanted to be on the big stage. So, of course, we said, yeah. And there I was with little Johnny on the tones at 11 and a half years old in my, little soprano, beautifully vibrato voice, with the Coasters and the Duprees and everything, And then my father, who was divorced, and I came out of an orphanage when I was, 4 years old, because my mother put me there when I was 1 year old, me and my sister. But when I met my father, he was a really good guy who I had been, poisoned about, but he turned out to be a great guy. He got me into the Finnish Hall and, sang to about 300 Finnish people, because he lived in a building in East Harlem that was kind of all Finnish. It was really weird. Uh-huh. It was right up next to the Stax Studios. He used to go drinking with Jack Webb and all those people, from Dragnet,
Right.
And but he got me into Finnish Hall, and I sang it. He saw I was very good and very easy on stage. And then he knew one of the cats from the Apollo. He got me on the nights where you go and amateur night to sing in front of people and everything. And I brought the house down, which I thought was amazing because there wasn't one white person in the audience, it was kind of funny. But so I ended up doing a lot of doo-wop shows, and I discovered rock and roll. And rock and roll was really just an absolute, you know, supreme surprise to me, you know?
Yeah.
So I think one of my first real bands was Sparrow, and we used to do a lot of the Peppermint Lounge, the Headliner, the Wagon Wheel, you know, in Times Square. And we worked for $100 a man doing 8 sets a night, 7 nights a week, and we thought that was great money, you know?
And is this like the mid-60s, late 60s?
Yeah, it was the mid-60s, yeah. It was 63, 64, 65. And then, you know, clubs started popping up, you know, and I went from Sparrow to Breakwater, a couple of years in Sparrow, and then Breakwater, which I put together with Nicky Martin, or Nicky Marticelli, he was at the time, but Nicky Martin from Street Punk, and Danny Sicardi, who was later Piper, and many other people, and a bunch of really good New York musicians, and this crazy piano player named Dane Meigand, who was out of his freaking mind, but oh, could he play piano.
Yeah.
And we'd just rip it up doing, you know, anything we wanted to play, whether it was cover, whether it was originals, because I was always writing, you know, whether it was just blues, whether it was jazz. We just did any freaking thing we want with the group Breakwater. But we got a lot of gigs, and we opened for a lot of people around, you know, and it was fun. And that took me kind of into the 70s, where I was working with Billy Squire up in Boston. And Nicky and Danny and a whole bunch of, you know, the musicians, we were putting sort of a super group up there where I was singing, Billy was playing guitar, and Nicky was playing guitar, Danny bass, and the drummer was Dave. I can't remember his last name, Dave. But anyway, we got busted, but we were targeted by this, you know, Greenfield police because we were long-haired, skinny, and bold and brash and drunk all the time, you know?
Yeah.
So we literally, day we were coming home from rehearsal, we were all loaded, and we saw this roundhouse with we were boarded up, so we thought nobody lived there. So I shimmied through the window, and I heard this voice say, "Is that you, Bill?" And I actually said, "No, this is just a dream. Go back to sleep." And later on in the trial, when they read that back, oh my God, the courthouse erupted. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But they arrested me because Billy actually sort of inadvertently let slip that I was the one that went in the house, you know, and which really pissed me off. And then he took the band all back to New York and left me in jail up there.
This was Billy Squire?
Squire, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, Billy and I have since made friends many years later. We shook and you know, let the past be the past, but, in fact, I ran into him last week. But the thing was, you know, I ended up doing 4 months in Franklin County Prison Farm, which was just an absolute, you know, once they close the doors on you and you can't move and they take away your freedom, boy, that's something else.
Yeah, that doesn't sound fun.
No, everything else I could deal with, you know what I mean? Because I was a tough kid from Hell's Kitchen, nothing scared me. But when they take your freedom away, it's a whole different story. So when I got out, I came back down to New York City. First thing I did was get even with Billy by sleeping with his girlfriend. That's number one. That took care of that. And then I went and started hanging out in probably one of the coolest clubs of all time, which was called Nobody's. Nobody's was just a bar on Bleecker Street in the West Village, owned by the Chinese Chin family, right?
Uh-huh.
And but it became a place that every English rock superstar and American rock superstar wanted to hang out in. So you would walk in there one night, and you had to have it all together. You would come in there, or else you'd be shunned, you wouldn't be served, whatever. You had to have it all together. Back then, we're all, you know, I was 6'3", 160 pounds, with velvet coats and black T-shirts and tight dungarees, you know, and stuff like that, you know, in silk scarves around us, you know. Long curly blonde hair and stuff, and you know, you're standing next to Robert Plant, you know, him and I became friends, and the guys from the Kinks and the Stones and Janis Joplin, you know, every night being sort of, you know, I hate to say, a little drunk and a little out of sorts and smoking so much that, oh my God, her breath smelled like India, but And Bonzo being out of his freaking gourd one day, he's so drunk he throws a friend of mine into the wall for no reason at all. Big fight ensues, and all of a sudden I have Robert in the grass. I'm breaking a bottle. He's over there, and we look at each other and we just start laughing. Because he's tall and 6'3 and curly blonde hair, and I'm tall and 6'3 and curly blonde hair.
Yeah.
And we're laughing. And he says, "Hey, what the fuck are we fighting about, man?" You know, he says, "It's Bonzo, man. He's nothing." Yeah, he is. You know, it was just funny. And that's how the fight broke. And that's how we became friends, you know?
Yeah.
But it was an incredible place. And that you walk, I remember David Clayton Thomas used to come in from Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And none of the girls would pay attention to him because he was short, squat, and really short hair, and he didn't look anything like the rock stars of the time, you know?
Yeah.
And so he would come like, "Don't you know who I am? I'm David Clayton Thomas." And the girls would just snicker, you know? It was really funny. And then we'd go from there to the Steve Paul scene, or we would go for dinner at the Haymarket, which was a British pub around the corner in the hotel. And we'd all go there and drink lager and lime and whiskey and you know, eat steaks. And then we'd go to the scene, which was 46th and Restaurant Row. And it was this downstairs club that Teddy Slatus was the doorman at. And Teddy Slatus used to literally rule with an iron fist. You had to be a star to get in there or a very talented musician. So I was known to all throughout New York for singing and writing and fronting bands and having the right look and brash and so on and so forth, you know. So I got in easily. But stories would happen, and you'd see it. Like, I remember one of these, what we would call garmentos, and they were big sort of, you know, guys that made their money in the garment industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one time this garmento was coming down the street, and you could pin him from a mile away, and he had this gorgeous blonde with this incredible body next to him. And he comes down, and once again, Teddy says, "No." And he says, "What do you mean?" And he takes a $100 bill out of his pocket and hands it to Teddy. Teddy just lifts it up, rips it in half, and gives it back to him and says, "Get out of here." And the guy is screaming and yelling and this and that, and starts walking back up the stairs. And I'm watching this whole thing, me and my drummer, Charlie Davidman, who's the drummer in Street Punk. And we're watching him, and the girl turns around with these pleading eyes, "Please let me, you know." And I say to Teddy, the girl, he says, "Yeah, go ahead." I say, "Come on down." The guy's screaming to Belly, and the girl gets in with us. It was funny. But that's what the scene was. Because the McCoys were the house band there, so the jamming that went on, man, I jammed with Beck and Clapton and all these people at the Steve Paul scene. I remember one time I'm sitting through over this gorgeous girl sitting at the small bar at the front of the place when you walked in on the right. And I get a tap on my shoulder. She says, "Mike, can I have a cigarette?" I said, without even looking. She says, "Mike, can I have a match?" She says, "Mike, can I have a date with your girl?" And it's Robert Plant. He's busting my balls. You know? And I said, "Get the fuck out of here, you." It was funny, but one night we're there, and everybody's sitting on the floor waiting because, you know, everybody, the people that ran the place said that a really big surprise was coming. So now you're sitting on the floor with Janis Joplin, the Kinks, all the Stewart musicians, everybody, the Stones guys, and everything. And out comes, what the hell was the name of they were kind of a doo-wop, outfit, a parody of doo-wop, and Bowser was, the star, the comedian. He was just, you know, like, it was like a Grease kind of band. And they did this comedy doo-wop, and I remember everybody howling, Plant is peeing his panties howling so much. Everybody's lying on the floor, back laughing their asses off, man. It was just the funniest fun. It'll pop into my head. But anyway, that's what happens when you get older. You forget things, you know?
Yeah.
But the way Street Punk came together was when I was in Nobody's. I was just standing there with a couple of girls, and this song came on. I just kind of belted it out and put a real, real power riff on it. And this guy Charlie walks up, and he's got a great look, real curly blonde hair, good looking, great shape, well dressed. He walks up and he says, "Oh wow, you can really sing." I said, "Yeah." He said, "What's your name?" He says, "Oh," I said, "John Montgomery." He says, "Oh, I know you. You work with Bill. You work out of Bessie, yeah." And he said, "Let's put a band together." Just that was the beginning. Let's put a band together.
Yeah, right.
He said, "Do you know musicians?" I said, "Sure. Mickey Martin, Danny, everybody." But he knew this bass player named Donnie Nassov. Now, Donnie was a great bass player. He's been with John Waite and Pat Benatar and many people. You know, great bass player.
Mm-hmm.
And so we took him in and the aforementioned Dane Migand. Actually, it was first Bobby Blaine. Now, Bobby Blaine was a notorious, incredible piano player who had a really bad, bad habit of stealing and ripping people off. So when we got together to play, it was kind of magic because Nicky was a blues monster and a slide monster, right? Danny was just a quirky kind of bass player in line of the bass player from Free, you know?
Yeah.
With those kind of runs and almost bass leads at the time, you know? Charlie was a technical studied drummer, so his timing and rhythms were just perfect. And Bobby was the nastiest piano player that, you know, you'd think he was a New Orleans piano player. I remember writing Master of Flash with him, the very first tune, which became my nickname in New York, the Master of Flash. And I started writing it with him, and then I started writing songs with Nicky, It's a Right and Devil's Daughter and a Gambling Man, and, you know, things just that just flowed out of us on tour and on gigs. But I remember Bobby, we went up to Boston to debut at the Scarborough Fair for really nice money, and it was really strange because it was a Aerosmith haunt. They played there a lot, right? So the fans would not applaud for anybody unless, you know, you would absolutely overwhelm them. So we do the first song, there's no applause, and I go, "What the fuck?" I turn around to everybody. Now, you got to understand, they had never seen me work before, the band. It was our very first gig.
Right.
And all of a sudden, I said to them, "Master of Flesh, follow my lead, just watch me." And everybody tells the story, basically, that I took the mic, basically whipped it around my head, threw it up in the air, caught it, came down, bent all the way back in a split, and the band hit into the opening crash of Master of Flesh, which is a huge, powerful Bowie-esque kind of ballad, you know,
right,
with
yeah.
a huge hook. So anyway, I'm working the stage like a freaking madman. The emotion's pouring out of me. The voice is soaring. And all of a sudden, when it finishes, one person pops up and could not control it. She said, all of a sudden, the whole audience pops up and gives us a standing ovation. We won them over on the second song, you know. But during the trip, we had become friends with another band, and they invited us over to their house to party with and this and that. And Bobby stole the things with the tassels coming down from them, suede kind of coats with the tassels coming down that were very popular at the time.
Yeah.
He stole one from the guy and put it in his guitar case, and we're leaving and heading down, and he opens it and he shows it to us, and we said, "What the fuck did you do?" Well, we turned around and went all the way back and gave it back to him, and then threw Bobby out of the band because he had done things like that before. So we went four-piece, me on vocal and Nicky on guitar, and we ended a lot of doing a lot of shows. We did it with Todd Rundgren at the Diplomat with Kiss, you know, opening Kiss with my good friends Luger, We were just, because our songwriting put us above and beyond, because it was my melodies and lyrics that did it, because I'm a known songwriter and have been for many years, and to this day make my money selling songs and producing people when I write all their songs.
Right.
But the point being, we literally were in the press all the time, every time. People were stunned, big, powerful, publicists and writers and stuff would manage us, and we were turning down record deals to the point where we started squabbling with each other. And then after we did the Kiss thing as a favor to Kiss at the Diplomat, they got their deal and were well on their way, and they came back and brought their management to see us. This was Gia Coyne. And Gia Coyne loved us and wanted us up in his office at 9:30 in the morning. he's running through his tab how much money it would take to break us of that $450,000. And then as we were getting up, he said, and of course I'll have your publishing. And I pulled my hand back. I said, I can't. I was with that Famous Music at the time, which is Paramount's publishing. I had signed a publishing deal. Me and Nikki had signed it about 4 weeks earlier. So the deal fell through, and that was the beginning of the end for street punk, because for some reason they thought they blamed me for it when it really wasn't me. It was a certain drug habit of someone in the band, I won't say who, out of respect, that was the heaviest drug of all, and all the problems that it caused, and evidently broke up the band in late 74, and that was that.
It's alright to treat me like you do, 'cause girl, you know I want you to. It's okay to do all the things that you say. Oh girl, I like it that way. It's alright.
So were you involved in the Mercer Arts Center scene?
Yeah. We played there a bunch of times in the Casey Room and the Oscar Wilde Room and the rotating big stage with all of the bands, basically, with the Harlots of 42nd Street, Riff Raff, the Magic Tramps, Kiss, Luger. All of us were doing that scene, the Dolls. Everyone was doing that scene, because it was a great place to play. You actually made money. It was a built-in crowd. And the rotating stage was fabulous, because it was seats that went up and the stage went round, so you could see from all the way around,
right?
You know? And but even the smaller rooms on the side had great PAs and good stages and clean, you know. They were not CBGBs with rats crawling on you. These were nice, really nice stages, you know, and clean rooms. So after our gigs there, we went to the next weekend. We were booked at Max's Kansas City, which was the epitome of rock in New York at the time, you know?
Yeah.
And we literally took the stage and were introduced as the band that brought the house down at Broadway Central, Mercer Arts Center, because the Broadway Central collapsed, crushing Mercer, and we had left two amps there that we were going to pick up next week, and they're okay, and they got crushed too, you know.
Right.
So that's how we would build at Max's, and I remember that Max's show. I'm wearing a pair of Charlie's satin pants, and I did one of these crazy moves that I didn't split the pants in the back, and the audience is howling. I had to run backstage really quick and change it to my jeans again, you know. But we debuted Somewhere Over the Rainbow with this incredible lead that would just be, you know, and then I'd sing this beautiful, almost legitimate voice, which I always had, you know, and it stunned everybody. And needless to say, oh my God, the gay crowd went nuts over us, because it was one of their anthems, you know. So I was approached then by, we did some sessions for Bette Midler, and she was a sort of a friend of mine. And I saw her at Sweeney Todd's, which was a cabaret club that we would all go and sing acoustically out piano, and it was featured many of the Helen Schneiders and stars of that time in the cabaret world, you know?
Yeah.
And Bette brings me over to a table and introduces me to the editors of this, magazine called After Dark. And Street Punk had done a photo session for After Dark a couple of weeks earlier, and I was asked if I would do nude shots afterwards, and my manager's in back going, no. And he said, would you at least lie to, you know, the gay world is like weird. But a lot of photographers were at the time, right? And so I did it in this little shorts that we would all wear in those days, dungaree shorts, and a studded belt, and that was it. Well, at Night Arena Sweeney's, I walk over to meet them, and he says, yep, he's the one. I have no idea what he's talking about. And Beth said, oh, it's a surprise. Well, about 3 weeks later, I'm walking down the street, and I see a whole bunch of gay guys looking around, you know, saying, oh, he's gorgeous. Oh, he's dealing with that. And I look at him, and I go, oh, my God, that was me. And it was me on the cover of After Dark magazine in that shot, you know, which has become, you know, there were some actually gay bidding wars over it at the time for the covers when the magazine folded.
Yeah.
It was really funny, but oh, the teasing I took, but oh, man, the girls went nuts and the guys went nuts. So I was fighting off guys all the time. It was really weird. Now, we'd be in the back room with Max's, and David Johansen would yell out because he was really jealous. He would say, how many guys did you have to screw for that one, John? I'd say, it's not the amount of guys, David. It's the quality of guys. You know, and it'd go back and forth, and it was funny. But, you know, we would just rule the back room of Kansas City, and it was heaven. I mean, you'd be hanging out with Alice Cooper, and you'd be hanging out with all the stars and the models and the jet setters and the Warhol people and Wayne County and all the crazies that were, you know, Mickey Ruskin's Max's Kansas City was rock and roll heaven and the art scene heaven. Because if you had no money, all you had to do was get 30 cents to buy a beer, and then you could eat out of the, you know, the warmers that kept all the sort of food hot that they use in these bars and stuff.
Yeah.
And then you could go and eat for it. And if you didn't have the money, you could eat anyway, and you'd run a little tab and you'd pay it back. Mickey had a heart of gold for rockers and artists and painters and writers, you know. That's just the way he was. So Max's became our home, and everybody was, I'll meet you at Max's, I'll meet you at Max's, you know.
And so
and it was heaven.
So, but Kiss never played at Max's, did they?
No, they never did. They never did. Yeah. They were sort of a different kind of band. You know, they were the first of what you would call the methodical, you know, back and forth, head bobbing down, you know, up in unison type bands,
yeah,
you know.
Choreography, yeah.
Yeah, choreographed because Sean Delaney did all that stuff. And
right.
He tried to work with us years later with a group called Dancer and tried to get me to go on my knees in the first song. And I told him, and the guys also said, you know, he's the best motherfucking frontman in the city. Don't tell him what to do. He knows what to do naturally, you know.
Yeah.
But it was funny. And it was, but they were the first. They were friends in those days, basically. But they came to me and Nikki one time and asked me if they could buy the two songs for $20,000 a piece, but we would have to take our names off it. And Nikki and I tell them to go fuck themselves, you know.
Yeah.
But later on, when Tomorrow and Tonight came out and I Want to Rock and Roll All Night, they had taken my song Rock and Roll Appetite and made it into two songs. So they did this. I had this song was She Had a Rock and Roll Appetite, just want to rock all day and roll all night. And they turned it Tomorrow and Tonight, Tomorrow and Tonight, we want to rock all day and roll all night. That's what they turned it into.
Right.
And it made them a friggin' fortune. They were too big for me to sue, you know? It was too big. I could not afford a lawyer that would take that on. Basically, we didn't know about contingency and all that stuff at the time, you know? But, so that was that. I mean, people were stealing from me all the time. It was just, I figured a sign of respect. So I would write those songs in 5 minutes, you know what I mean? And anyway, so, you know, Kiss became what they became because they did everything that Guy asked, which is what he asked them the night we played with them, because it was the night they were actually signed to him. And he said, are you guys willing to do? And we heard them, you know, say willing to do everything I ask, no questions, just do it to become what we want you to become. They said, yes, 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 yes. That was it.
So you actually know? Were listening in on the conversation between Bill Coyne and Kiss when
uh-huh.
he was signing them?
Yeah, because they were stanchions put up like you know, almost those offices they build nowadays with, you know, a million people can work in them and the different. They were stood up so we could see them right through the, you know, right over the stanchions, right, and listen to them, basically.
Yeah.
And remember Guy Coyne standing in front of them and giving them their that pitch, you know what I mean? And they were smart. Gene was very smart. Paul could be a little stupid, a little skeevy at times. Ace was the nicest of them. Just a friendly guy with a really high-pitched voice. How are you, John? He would talk, and it was really funny. And, I mean, Ace and I would go drinking. He'd be sitting next to me on a bar at the nursery, and all of a sudden he'd be gone. He'd be just lying on the floor. I'd say, get back up, Ace. Hey, Dad. And he'd just get back up on the stool again. It was just, he was a funny guy. Peter was okay. I'm good friends with Lydia Chris, who used to be married to Peter.
Right.
And she goes, goes out with Richie Fontana now.
Right.
And they live a couple of blocks from me, and Richie has MS. And
really?
And but she takes care of him. He's a dear friend of mine. And we all get together when Richie can go out for a little while, you know.
Yeah, I have her book, Sealed with a Kiss, Lydia's book. I have That's a great book, yeah.
It is, yeah. I have one down here signed by her. Thank you for being a part of the greatest time of my life, you know. It's really nice.
Yeah, you were talking about earlier about how you worked with Billy Squire and then how he, you know, threw you under the bus or whatever. But and so that's obviously pre-Piper, right?
Yeah, that's pre-Piper, basically. Yeah. That was the, you know, throughout my career in the 60s and the 70s, we would always try to put together these super groups with the, I mean, we tried once with Billy Joel and a couple of guys I was working with, Leo and Charlie from Child Harold, and tried to put together this super group, you know, when we realized that all these egos just couldn't work together, and that's not how bands are built, you know. So I think the prime example of that might have been Blind Faith, which only did one album and then couldn't go any further than that, you know. But, yeah, so, you know, all of the aspect of the world we lived in back then, we were happy with it. We were making good music. It was original music. Everybody was writing. Everybody was hanging out. Everybody was together. There were no enemies. You know, we did shows together, the three of us on one night that would pack the house, which they don't do anymore, you know?
Yeah.
Now it's 9 bands a night. As long as you draw 10 people times 9, they make 90, they make money, you make nothing, you know?
Yeah.
But the times that we would, I mean, we were poor when we started out as street punk, and we'd drink a fifth of cheap red Thunderbird or something, then go out drinking to nobody's. So it wouldn't cost us a lot of money, but there were always girls to pay our tabs and stuff, and that was always cool, you know? And, but we go from there to, you know, Max's Kansas City to the scene. And this was just done every night by the same 150 people. It was amazing. We lived a life that 99.9% of the world could not do. We pushed the fantasy of nightlife, staying out till 5, sleeping with 1, 2, 3, 4 women at a time. You know what I mean? Drinking every day. I was not big into drugs. It wasn't my thing. Drinking I enjoyed. And, because everybody around me, it was a very social time, you know. And it was a spectacular world that we lived in, and it probably will never come again, you know.
No, yeah.
It's music that was real. It was, you know, analog. It was really played by real musicians who could really play instruments and sing. Look like stars, acted like stars. Now it's mouse music, you know, I call it computer music, where, you know, if you want to make a chord on your track, you hit this note, and then hit arpeggiate, and there you go. That's not music. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of the way we sort of went through that time period in a dream world. In a musical world that, you know, later on when I was asked to become part of Foreigner in the early days and worked with Mistress and China Blue and Perfect Stranger and you know, all the way up to the when I decided to stop touring and everything and started writing. I had a love of Broadway. I wrote two off-Broadway shows.
Right.
One was Hell's Kitchen the Musical. That told my story of getting out of Hell's Kitchen and my tough life in Hell's Kitchen. And the other was The Edge, which was also but wasn't a musical, it was a straight play. And both of them ran off Broadway and were successful for the time that they ran, you know?
Yeah.
And, but I just turned to production, you know, years later when I came back from my latest tour and realized I just couldn't save any money. It wasn't that I didn't make the money, I just couldn't save it, you know?
Yeah.
We were not exactly financial analysts, you know. but I started, you know, producing people because I was always very good in the studio, and I sort of began putting my money into building my own studios in my home because I had the extra room to do it. Believe it or not, in a home on West 72nd Street, right off Central Park West, down the block from John Lennon, who I partied with many times, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a foyer that was 10 by 10, allowed me to build my studio. And I drove some people nuts in the building over the years, but for the most part, I was very respectful, started producing, became a great engineer, great producer, great arranger. And that's how I make my money now. I produce people, and they always need writing, so I write the songs for the album, bring in all my musicians to play on all of them, so they all make money from what I do. And I sing for the New York Blues Project now.
Mm-hmm.
And we play all over New York, and we do some festivals. We do the Montreal Blues Festival, and we'll do a lot more festivals this year coming up, you know. And I'm singing better than I ever sang. It's really, really cool, and I'm 65 years old.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's amazing that you've been able to, you know, make a living your whole life off of music, basically. That's the dream, right? You don't have to be rich and famous if you just... You're still doing what you love, so...
Exactly. You do not have to be rich and famous. The respect of all my peers from all the many, many, many stars in this business that know who I am and know the quality of my writing. When I pop a song onto Facebook, people go nuts over it. And people who didn't know me are going to realize, they say, oh, my God, what kind of a writer you are. When I'm on Reverb Nation, my songs are on there. I mean, I get comments like, you're the only true writer on this whole site. Every song of yours is well put together, beautiful melody, beautiful lyric, beautiful hook. It's such an honor to know you, and so on and so forth. You know, these are the comments I get every day because writing is my thing. Not just rock and roll, but blues, soul, funk, R&B. I can write rap. I can write adult contemporary. I can write Broadway musicals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just writing has been my vein. And now singing is, I lost my wife to cancer 3.5 years ago. It was the worst time of my life. And one thing she wanted, and on her deathbed asked me to get back to singing and to meet another woman. Well, I could honor the get back to singing, which I did, and I'm going to put the New York Blues Project together, which has a bunch of phenomenal musicians in it. And then 1.5 years later, I met a woman, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I honored her that way, but... it was a hard time in my life, but all my friends and family pulled me back together, and I started up again producing and, you know, working with people. I'm doing two albums right now for people, and for the original Street Punk, I have them somewhere, but I can't find them. When I'm on my computer collection a while ago, I lost so many tracks on iTunes that I had to start putting back in. And I couldn't find the original that Donnie had sent me. But I'll find it eventually. When I do, I'll get it to you.
The stuff that you recorded in the 70s? Or?
No, the 70s tapes, cassette tapes, just died. They just died.
We did
McLean Street Studio, and they died. We did Rock and Roll Appetite, Master of Flesh, Devil's Daughter, and they just died.
And you ain't
producer brought us in there, and actually we ended up producing ourselves more than anything, which, because I was already had a good ear. But the point being, when I decided to re-record those with some of the old musicians and get them back out there again, it seems like the interest in street punk goes through the roof, because people just start commenting on, you know, how truly great the writing was and way before its time and so on and so forth, you know. And I gained just a whole bunch of new fans, you know. Mm-hmm.
Do you
but
have,
it's, sorry.
Do you have any recording of Rock and Roll Appetite at all?
I don't have a viable one. The last one was on the, actually somebody else recorded it recently, but I'm going to record it, probably within the next 2 weeks.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm slowly putting together the whole street punk album, and I'm going to release it on Bridge Across Records.
Okay.
Soon, because it'll sell like crazy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to add that to it in a couple of weeks, and I'll send that to you when I do.
Okay.
Finish it, because everybody wants to kind of record it with, after all the cats that did the sessions for this album that I produced, where this artist wanted to recover it. They said, "Jesus Christ, Johnny, can't you sing that? Can't you just..." And I said, "No, you can't do that to an artist, you know. But I can do my own version, which I will do, and I'll sing it in today's kind of way and produce it today's way. Still keeping the big hook, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I won't sing it as straight as I did then. I'll put a little more of the riffing that I do naturally now in my voice, you know. But it's still a phenomenal song, and remembered by so many people, you know."
Mm-hmm. So you said that you guys were turning down record deals in the 70s, huh?
Yeah, there were a bunch of deals. Our manager and publicist basically were very high-powered, and they got us to... I remember Sire Records, Seymour yeah. Stein and Linda had seen us at... where was it we were playing? Oh, it was the old Kenny's Castaways when it was uptown on East 84th Street.
Right.
And it was a very kind of famous club where everybody, because the owner was very good with bands and understood music and stuff and loved music. He was an Irishman, and he was very cool. And so we got to play there a lot. We'd work with Barnaby By there a lot, with the Marshall Tucker Band a lot, you know. And you play a whole week, which was really cool, you know. And one time me and Nikki were doing a blues set with just acoustic with the Blues Project guys, Danny and them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing all blues. And I remember I came off stage and the owner introduced me to Willie Dixon, who was sitting there enjoying himself immensely because being a blues master. And Willie says to me, he says, "Son, says you got some blues and some black in you somewhere. I swear it," he said to me. It's funny, you know. But that's where they, Sire Records came to see us. Henry brought Sire Records there. And he brings us over to the table, and they were offering us drinks and everything, and Linda is literally wrapping herself around my leg. She was like friggin' ugly, plain English, as was Seymour.
Yeah.
And so this is the deal he offered us, that he would release our demos.
Uh-huh.
The demos that we did at Green Street.
Yeah.
And our manager said to him, just stood up and said, "John, let's get out of here. This ain't a motherfucking deal." Well, Sire was just starting out at the time, so you can almost understand that, but you don't start out with no money.
Right.
You know what I mean? If you're going to be a record company, you got to have a studio to be able to bring acts in to record them the way they should be recorded, you know? So we MGM offered us a deal. We turned it down, and a bunch of other labels, because he was always looking for the big deal, the one with the big advance and the $1 million, you know, because they were giving them out at the time, you know.
Yeah.
And eventually, we just got tired of it, and we fired them, and we didn't hang on much longer than that. But I remember, in one of the newspaper ads, the band Street Punk involved in a heavy lawsuit with Henry Edwards, who was our manager at the time. That never came to anything. But we were always appearing in the news, on TV and in many, just everywhere in magazines and Cream rock scene, and even Melody Maker from England wrote this incredible thing about me. You know, it was just fun days, and people recognize the talent, but, you know, it isn't always talent that gets you to the top.
Yeah.
No matter how good you are, you got to do things the way they want you to do them, and street punk would never do that. Never.
Well, there are plenty of bands in the 70s that signed record deals that they shouldn't have signed and just got ripped off.
Yeah, they did in incredible ways, you know. And it was sad to see, because these guys were all friends of ours. And they were good, and they were talented, and they were, you know. But you saw it happening to bands like Badfinger.
Yeah,
one of the most incredible bands of all time.
Yeah,
how they were screwed by their business manager. When they had a couple of number one hits, they were still all living in the same house with their girlfriends because no money was given to them, you know.
Yeah.
And then in 73, 74, when they did that album that Warner Brothers shelved.
Yeah, Wish You Were Here. That's their best album, probably.
It's an incredible album. I play it probably every 3 days when I'm cleaning the house or doing dishes or cooking. I put it on and crank it, you know what I mean? It's an incredible album, and they got fun. You know, two of them ended up killing themselves over, you know, that kind of, you know, because, you know, Pete Ham, was loyal to the manager and realized what a mistake he made later on, couldn't face his band and hung himself, you know? Yep. Terrible. But, oh, yeah, I'm in agreement. That's a phenomenal album, you know?
Yeah, I love it. So there were so many, there's this whole list of these New York rock bands in the 70s that never even had a record out, you know?
Yeah,
street punk, of course, and then, like, Luger with, Ivan Kral's band, and they,
That's Ivan Kral. That was more Shane Harris's band than Ivan Kral's
band.
Shane was on his way. Shane is still a dear friend of mine. He lives in Florida now. We talk 4 times a week. He considers me his older brother, because I brought him into the second street punk with Ricky Bird, and Alan Nolan, and, you know, some of the guys from Piper and stuff, you know, and, he turned out to be one, you know, we hung together, lived together, and our girlfriends were sisters, you know, and it was just an incredible time. We became, and we're still best friends to this day. I go down to see him in Florida. He comes up to see me in New York, you know. He sends me cigarettes from Florida because they're cheap. But and Ivan, you know, Ivan and I wrote some songs together, and Ivan just called, actually, you know, Shane in Florida and asked, can I get John's number? I'd like to do some writing with him, because everybody wanted to write with me. And when Ivan and I wrote, probably some of the best things he ever did was when he was writing with me.
Mm-hmm.
But Ivan, you know, everybody was a part of that scene. When Eric Emerson was the lead for the Magic Tramps, you know.
And he was a part of the whole Andy Warhol scene.
Yeah, he was. He was just an affable, friendly, warm, like a fairy godfather, you know what I mean? He was just like a little magic tramp was a perfect name for them. He was like an imp.
Yeah.
You know? But we all have tons of pictures with him and Bill's with the Magic Tramps.
Someone else sing. I sing it. My song. When I wash my confession, together we stand alone. When I have my selection, I'd rather be on my own. To do it my way, to do what I say, I'd like to live and be free. Not to mention my profession, that's part of my event for me. In my group of magicians,
Sessu's still a dear friend of mine. He lives out of state, but he comes in every now and then.
Sessu Coleman?
The drummer. Yeah, the drummer.
Yeah, I've heard a couple Magic Tramp songs. I've never heard anything by Luger. I don't know. There's nothing on YouTube or anything like that.
No, Shane has some Luger sessions because, you know, in those days we didn't have the commercial cameras to film us, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Some of the early, the Dolls got some early footage, basically, but I don't, I mean, there's a video of me in 1981 when I was with a band called Le Mans, and I'm doing this incredible song, We All Come Out to Play, which was like a New York anthem, and to like 1,000 people at Great Gildersleeve's, you know, and it's a great video, and it's a beautiful song, and it's a great arrangement, and the place goes nuts for me there, but that's the earliest consumer camera. I remember the guy saying he had just bought one for like $1,500,
yeah.
You know, and he was on the steps from the balcony downstairs. He was sitting on the steps filming me, and he actually filmed the home show, but a lot of it would break up and so on and so on. But the best one was We All Come Out to Play, so I just saved that one, put it on YouTube and put it on my websites and stuff, you know. And it's a shame, but the bands were so good, and Riff Raff was a terrific band, and the Harlots of 42nd were so entertaining. Luger was fun.
Harlots of 42nd, they had a single, which I've heard online, and then I found a couple of other songs of theirs on another website that were from an acetate, it said. And there's a great Teenage Lust song on YouTube. I think it's called Teenage Lust.
Dust is still a good friend, you know. Harold is still a dear friend of mine,
right.
And I last saw him down at the Lancey's when he was so blown away by seeing me with tears in his eyes, you know, because these were times when they had the 220 Club that we'd hang out in, that they actually ran, and they had these cool lofts that we all hang out in, and we all did shows together, so we were good friends. And I didn't get along with Billy Joe White, their singer, too much because his ego was, but Harold was a great guy, still is a great guy. And, you know, whenever his health is not good, but whenever his health is good, we try to get together.
Right.
And he's always posting hilarious stuff on Facebook.
Yeah, you know? I see his stuff on Facebook, yeah.
Right.
And and you talked about lofts. Like, I think the Bratz, their loft was one of the big places where you had a lot of shows, right?
Every boy has a mother.
well, we never played at the Bratz Loft. We played a lot of gigs with the Bratz,
yeah,
but
right.
never at the Bratz Loft. We played with them a lot out at Coventry and you know, Foolish Pleasure, places like that. You know,
Coventry was in Long Island City, right?
Or no, it was actually in Sunnyside. It was 45th Street, Queens Boulevard.
Yeah, I used to, when I lived in New York, I lived in Long Island City. It wasn't too far from where the
No, yeah,
was.
Pretty close. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was maybe 3 train stops. Back in but that was, I mean, Kiss played Coventry a lot.
Yeah.
Everybody did. We all played Coventry, and we have many bills there with us with lots of different, and you know, stars and stuff. And I remember one night at Coventry, which is a big place, and it actually had 2 stages on it, so bands could go on right after each other,
right,
without switching equipment, right.
Uh-huh.
And one night Nikki said something to somebody in the big opening hallway as she came in from a local tough guy who was this girl. Nikki said something, and the guy said, "Who the fuck are you talking to?" And Nikki went into, Nikki was always crazy because he was always high. And
yeah.
he'd go on this, he was like a tarpley, he would go on this crazy, wild, wacky, come on, I can't even, he would just freak other people out. The guy backed off, but then he came back with about 15 friends.
Uh-oh.
And we're at stage playing. And the Mission Mountain Wood Band is opposite us, and they're just watching when all of a sudden these guys come rushing onto the floor. There's about 250 people, and they are just swinging bats and punching and crazy and brass knuckles. So they're heading for the stage for Nikki. So Nikki takes his guitar off and starts swinging it with the you know, the heavy part, you know, toward their heads. He's swinging around. And Charlie's going to me, "Johnny, don't you dare," because he knew me. I was a fighter from Hell's Kitchen and an ex-boxer. So, but I said, "Sorry, Charlie." I just jumped in the crowd. I'm swinging, knocking people out like crazy. And, of course, I was wearing a pair of Charlie's pants again, and they ripped again as well as everything else did. But, oh, my God, what a melee it was. And the police came and broke it all up. And we didn't get arrested because we were in the band.
Yeah.
But a lot of them got arrested and pulled out of there and spent the night in jail. That was about it, you know. And we never heard anything about it again, but I remember recently Charlie told me that he ran into the guys from the Mission Mountain Wood Band or somehow reached them online or on Facebook or whatever. And they said, you know, to this day, we'll never forget that. That was just one of the highlights of our career, just seeing a fight right standing in front of us, seeing this fight and seeing the guys jump into it and going, what the hell kind of bands do they have in New York? They jump into fights, you know. But it was just a funny, funny time. And there were always these hilarious stories of what would happen. One time, Charlie and I were having sex, you know, sort of with these 2 girls in the Max's bathroom, and somebody reported us, and Mickey then threw us out. We were outside having a cigarette, and Mickey said, "Okay, it's been 5 minutes. We're back in, and now it's a, you know, it's a male and female bathroom, you know, co-ed bathroom." So, you know, things like that would happen all the time. You know, it was just a crazy, crazy time, you know. But, you know, and anything you want to ask me.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about a few of the other bands that were on. Like, do you remember the Rags?
Yeah, I remember Rags. Rags also was a very, kind of almost like a Stones-ish kind of band. You know, it was very loose musicianship, but fun, you know, up-tempo, really fun stage show. They were a good time band and a good band.
I'm a footloose cowboy, ghetto punk. You're my kind of girl, you got a lot of funk. So once you open up your velvet door, you gotta give me what's on the floor. 'Cause there's no difference between me and you. There's just one thing I'd like for you to do. It's to love me hard and love me long. And when morning comes, it will just be gone. Cause don't you know that Magnum lady's got me on the run? She's got a poison words and her machine gun. Magnum lady's got me on the run. She's gonna shoot me for the hole just for fun. Oh, look out for session.
And I saw one bill that was at the Hotel Diplomat in 74 that you were on with the Magic Tramps and Harlots of 42nd Street. And then there was another band called Cannon. Do you remember them?
Yeah, I remember them, but not much. They were a band that Mike Quashy, who produced that show, brought them in. They didn't sort of fit in with everybody. They were not exactly what... they were not from New York. I remember that.
Okay.
And how they got on the bill, I don't know. But all of us were sort of, you know, we were New Yorkers. And we were, even if people came from somewhere else, they lived in New York, you know. But that band wasn't so. I really don't remember. They went on first, and I don't remember anything about them, you know. The Harlots, I do. The Magic Tramps, I do. Because we all got along. We were all friends, and we all had a, you know, and everybody drunk and got high and had a ball together, you know.
Yeah.
So... No, and I don't remember them.
There's another band I've seen listed opening for the Dolls a couple times called Shaker.
But Shaker, again, was I wasn't that familiar with them. I remember them. I might have seen them once, but if you ask me if there was anything memorable about them, no.
Right.
Yeah, I don't even know who was in the band. They just made no impact on the scene or on... the bands that made an impact were the ones I mentioned, and plus Teenage Lust and you know, all the other...
And probably the Planets with Binky Phillips.
The Planets, yeah. The Planets were really fun. That's Binky. Binky Phillips, he's a master musician.
Yeah.
Great guy, and still plays to this day. You know, when he's healthy, he's had some health problems too. But, you know, a fun band, great guy. That was a little after... Now you're going into the Gildersleeves scene.
Okay.
And the Gildersleeves scene was, you know, I was there with the John Montgomery Group, with Two Perfect Strangers, with Le Mans, with a lot of different bands.
And the Planets played at CBGB's a lot, too.
Yeah, they did. They did. We never played CBGB's. We wanted to. I remember the first time I went into CBGB's. I could not believe the bathroom. I could not believe how dirty the place was. And it was like a health risk, you know?
Yeah.
And I was not into punk music. Never was, never will do. I always figured you had to be able to sing and play to be in a band, you know? So that never really sat with me. But I remember meeting this beautiful, sexy brunette who lived around the corner, and she... pulled me out of there right away, and she takes me upstairs. She, you know, this, she says to me, there's one thing I like. And I said, what's that? I do everything. She said, I want you to beat me up first. I said, I don't do that. And I was out there. I said, I'm not going to touch CBGBs with a 10-foot pole ever, you know? So that was my experience with CBGBs.
Well, they
all played there a lot, and everybody had a ball there. I could not stomach it. I would get sick if I was in there, you know?
Well, there was a little bit of crossover because I saw that Patti Smith played at the Hotel Diplomat before she even played at CBGB's. And,
yeah, she did, and she played Max's many times too, right. You know what I mean?
And television even played at the Hotel Diplomat in 74.
That's right. And actually, I worked with Billy Ficka, the drummer from Television, and Richie Lloyd used to audition for street punk all the time,
really?
You know, for a second guitar player, but he'd be asleep on drugs every time his term to come audition was. We said, no, that's not going to work. We already have enough of that, you know. But Patty would play Max's a lot. And when Ivan and Danny Kaye, who was a rock critic at the time, who could play guitar, and I remember Danny every time I see him, he would say, Chupon, Chupon. That's what he'd call us. You know, that's street punk. He'd say, hey, Chupon. It was funny. But he loved street punk, and as did Ivan and all the guys. She played CBGBs a lot, yeah.
And there were a few other bands I wanted to ask about if you have time. Are you okay
sure.
with time? Okay.
I'm good.
Well, did you know the band Milk and Cookies at all?
Yeah, I saw them because they played Gildersleeves, but I don't remember them. You know, first of all, a name like that would not be somebody we'd want to see.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. If you saw T. Roth and Another Pretty Face, you'd want to go see it.
I know. Yeah, I know Another Pretty Face. Yeah, I was going to ask you about them. So,
great band. And
yeah,
great
I have a
singer,
CD.
Terry
I have
Buck.
A CD by them that they put out years ago.
Yeah.
Just like on their own. They played at CBGB's too, right?
They might have. I don't know because he was not. He had a legitimate voice. They could really play. And they had good harmonies and they had really beautiful songs, you know.
And they were over. They had over the top glam image too, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah,
more similar
yeah.
to the Dolls.
Yeah. Well, all the glam stuff. I mean, street punk started that before anybody came along because we wore the platform shoes and. And I would wear these blue, really tight jumpsuits with all your junk kind of sticking out, you know?
Yeah.
And then we would, and we also started the punk thing because I remember all the Ramones and all the people were in the audience watching us and Debbie Harry, and who was with Stiletto at the time,
yep.
when we were at a place called Mushroom. And just out of being poor, we'd wear faded, ripped jeans, you know, ripped at the knee.
Yeah.
I would wear white platform shoes. Then I got tired of them and went to Capizio's, the dancer shoes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Converse sneakers, right? Or the Keds sneakers that were very plain and almost looked like the Capizio's. And I would wear leather jackets with no shirt underneath. Well, when the Ramones saw that, they said, "That's our look."
Yeah,
and they adopted it, and they, you know, but so many times we started trends basically because of the big audiences that came to see us, and all the other musicians that came to see us. We didn't do things to start trends; we did them because we were poor.
Yeah, right.
You know, it was funny.
Well, did speaking of the Ramones, did you see or play with the band Sniper that Joey Ramone was in before the Ramones?
Yeah, I remember them. I don't think I played with them, but I kind of knew them.
And were they a glam band?
A rock band.
Rock band?
Yeah, not a glam band, a rock band.
Okay.
I remember that one who became the drummer from Dust.
Yeah, yeah.
Played, yeah,
yeah, Marky Kenny Ramone. Marky Ramone.
Yeah, Marky, who was a great, great, great drummer. That had to become a really simple drummer to play with the Ramones, you know?
Yeah. And the first drummer of the Ramones, Tommy, he was in a band called Butch around
the
street punk time. Do you remember that?
Yep, I remember them. But didn't do much. Butch didn't do much.
Right.
But, in fact, they were a non-factor. But when he got the gig, he just fit because of his drumming style, straight ahead and simple, you know? And, you know, street punk did a whole, we were kind of had a British attitude about the way we did things, and we had really legitimate melodies and players and songs. So we were different from a lot of bands to, you know, the Dolls. It was when they were out and we were big together in New York, you know, 1,000 people go see them, 1,000 people come see us.
Yeah.
That's just the way it was, you know. Everybody else kind of fell in between, you know. But you know, at least we were all friends. We all got along, and we all played gigs with each other because we knew they would be good, you know, cool, friendly, hot nights, you know?
Yeah.
Anybody else you want to know about?
Did you know the Dictators at all?
Sure. Adney and all those people and Handsome Dick. Yeah, we knew them all, but we didn't gig with them. We never gigged with them. They were more in the vein of, you know, and more in the punk vein.
Yeah.
When they started out, they were sort of, you know, I knew them. I ran into them. We said hello. They know who I am. You know, it was like, but we never worked together because they were leaning to punk. Whereas if we, like, we played with the MC5 one time, they were rock and roll. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We played with Head East. We played with the Dead Boys. You know, they
Ooh,
were
we played
rock
with the
and roll.
Dead Boys. I love them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, they were great.
Where
they
did you play
great.
With them?
It was a loft party.
Okay.
I can't remember the loft, whatever, and they had set it up. I remember they just loved our name.
Yeah.
Funny. That's how we kind of met, you know. Actually, we were doing, when we were in the second Street Punk, we were doing the 82 Club, and Shane from Luger was on drums, and Alan Nolan and Ricky Bird was on guitar, and we were playing, and Lou Reed and David Bowie were in the audience. And I remember after the set, I'm standing there with just an open shirt, and the sweat is trickling down my chest, and I'm as skinny as can be in those days. And I'm holding a beer, and David comes over, and all these girls are gathered around, and David just grabs the beer out of me, takes a hit, gives it back. And for some reason, this girl stepped up and said, "Why are you drinking David's beer?" And David starts laughing. He says, "Nope, that's his beer. I was drinking it, you know." I said, oh, you know. But he said, "I got to tell you," he said, "the best fucking name I ever heard, Street Punk." He said, "The best. If somebody just said the word to me and I had heard it one before, it would have been my name." He loved the name so much, you know.
Yeah.
But he was a good guy, really classy, elegant, intelligent guy, you know. And he'd hang out and he'd drink champagne and he'd invite you over for champagne. He was just a sweet guy, you know. But I remember Lou Reed was there, and there was this woman in there named Rachel who was not a woman. She was a man who was very pretty as a woman, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember Lou, you know, he was hitting on her, and I went up to him and I said, you know, that's a man. And he went, so? He went out with her, him or whatever, for 6 months, you know. It's funny. Yeah.
What about
those were the days.
What about the Tough Darts with Robert Gordon? Did you see that?
They were great. It was key. Jeff Salem and the Tough Darts. They were a great band. They were a fun band. Robert could sing and perform. He had a little rockabilly way about him. Jeff was a very legitimate guitar player. Good friend of mine right up until the days he died when he owned a clothing store up there and we did some writing together.
Uh-huh.
And really nice guy. Excuse me. Down to earth. And very, very, very sweet guy, and you know, it's a shame they're gone now, but, you know,
yeah.
good band.
Yeah, they were like just a rock and roll band, and then they kind of transitioned into trying to be a punk band later, I guess.
Yeah. They did. But, you know, they always straddled that, you know. They were kind of just a step away from that anyway. But Jeff was always a legitimate guitar player, you know.
Yeah. And the band The Fast, were they sort of a part of
the Fast? No, they were sort of rock and roll, and they were before the punk movement.
Right.
We worked with them also, and they were very good and very prolific in their stage show and their performance. And you know, I remember like years later at Copperfields or some of the other in the mid to late 70s when these clubs popped up, and I was with Mistress with Mark Cunningham and a bunch of other good musicians. All of bands like Lover would come out, and Fair Warning, which was a great band, and The Fast played there, and many other people. So, you know, we were all playing the same clubs together, you know?
Yeah. And The Fast, they were wearing makeup before Kiss, right? I've read...
Yeah. They were... We all were before Kiss, but we didn't wear it to hide our faces. We would wear, you know, very light lipstick. We'd have a little blush and a little eyeliner, mostly the eyeliner, you know.
Yeah.
And because you look so faded on the big lights, and that was before lights were more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
And the lights would just blot out all your features. To this day, I wear sunglasses on stage because I'm always under the center light. So my face can sort of just disappear, you know.
Yeah.
especially with the blonde and graying hair, you know?
But I've seen, well, Mikey Zone, I think, actually wore, like, designs around his eyes, and I've seen where he basically says he thinks Kiss kind of stole the idea from him.
But... Well, it could be, because they saw, you know, their eyes were open to, you know, me for the writing, other guys for the look, and they just took off on all of it. You know, I mean, nobody wore the girls' dresses on stage before them, you know?
Right.
So that was, I mean, they were... It's just a shame, you know, because, you know, originally when in Nobody's, Johnny, who was Johnny Cinzano at the time, Cinzano, you know, came up to me and said, listen, we're building a band called the Dollfaces, and we'd like you and Nicky to be a part of it, you know. And so we went to Rogue Studio, we played two songs, and Nicky and I just walked out and said, no, Johnny, not going to work, and we left out, But believe it or not, I was supposed to be the original singer and Nicky the guitar player in the Doll Faces, which later became the Dolls, you know?
Right. So have you seen the quote? There's a Kiss book called Behind the Mask where Gene Simmons has a quote about street punk. Have you seen that?
Probably not, but can you read it to me?
Yeah, he says... street punk, a great little band. We always tried to help them out, but they killed themselves. They were their own worst enemy. That's what he said.
Well, in truth, we were, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we were not good little band. We blew Kiss off the stage, you know what I mean? We're not a good little band. We were a good big band because we had a huge sound, you know. But the point being, he tried to bring, as I said before, Gia Coyne, down.
Yeah, he wanted your publishing.
yeah, they wanted the publishing because it was the songs they were always after, you know what I mean? And they were not in the same class as what I did up front. They couldn't sing like me, they couldn't move like me. My movement was natural and fluid and flowing and sexy and everything, you know, without the choreographed nodding up and down and bending together and this kind of stuff, you know. So they could never do what I did and what my band did, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they did try to help us out. There's no two ways about it. And later on, they bought Master of Flesh the rights to it legally.
Right. That was Rocksteady. That was in 1980, right?
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking, you know, maybe Gene Simmons wrote a song and realized he kind of ripped Master of Flesh off, and then thought he should just buy it so that he wouldn't have legal issues later. Or...
Yeah, you never know, because they said that also compares to one of their, and I just don't know the name of it, but so many things that were stolen off me in those days became songs for other people, most, you know, notable being Kiss. So, you know, I don't hold that against anybody. I mean, just do it better. Don't do the eight common notes in a row. Change it a little bit, you know what I mean? But the aspect of, I always thought it was a sign of respect. I never wanted it in the way they wanted it, you know what I mean? To be told what to do, how to move, how to step, hide your, you know, whatever. I just had the respect of all the true, true, true talented people in the business, had it all my life, survived all my life, 65, still singing great, and still working and still producing and still writing and still, you know, helping so many people get started, that it's been a great life, you know?
Yeah, it sounds like it.
there you have it. That's my conversation with John Montgomery from Street Punk. I hope you enjoyed it. John was very gracious to speak with me and send me over those songs. You got to hear the three Street Punk songs, and this last song you just heard is John Montgomery, a more recent recording by John Montgomery called I Want to Be With You. And now, to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
We talked a lot about Kiss on this episode, and I'm going to leave you with a very early live recording of Kiss. This is a song I had never heard before until right around Christmas time of last year, 2013, when somebody posted it on YouTube, a great quality live recording of this very early Kiss song, probably dates back to the Wicked Lester days. It's a song called Life in the Woods. It was recorded at the Daisy in Amityville, New York in June of 1963, and I had never heard it before until a couple months ago. This is Kiss, Life in the Woods, live 1973. Till next time.
Guess what song? Life in the Woods. Everybody know what to do? Come on, mothers, let's go. Where's everybody? Let's get up and start dancing. We're not coming back here for a while. Let's get it out of our systems tonight.
Keeping in tune with the city, drifting along with the breeze, yeah.
said life in the woods would be so easy. We're gonna go through it one more time. We wanna get into it.
I'll be back.